Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the world change with the arrival of the miracle pill that lets women control their own fertility? Every day, about 10 million American women take oral contraceptives, which are so easy to obtain by prescription that many users take them for granted. Making the pill available originally took huge amounts of money, courage, and dedication. And this new technology brought health benefits and unprecedented new freedoms for women, but also significant theological and ethical concerns. Author Jonathan Eig is a former reporter for The Wall Street Journal. His new book is called The Birth of the Pill: How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. Jonathan, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much. I'm also a former reporter for the Dallas Morning News.
Oh, well, welcome home.
Thanks.
Let's start this conversation as you begin the book with the ever-fascinating Margaret Sanger. As you tell us in the first sentence, and I quote here, she was an old woman who loved sex and spent 40 years seeking a way to make it better. She had also witnessed firsthand the devastating consequences of unwanted pregnancies.
That's right. Sanger saw this as a very complicated issue, but she realized that the power of women being able to control their own reproduction was huge, and that it would obviously give women greater health, that they would be able to have fewer children. At the time, it was not uncommon for women to have six, seven, eight children, and this bore a terrible toll on their bodies, including Sanger's own mother, who died after being exhausted from giving birth to so many children. And she recognized that once women had that power to control their reproductive systems, that they would be able to enjoy sex the same way men did, without fear of becoming pregnant every time they engaged in those activities.
And so she dreamed of what she called a miracle pill that would essentially let women switch their fertility off and on at will.
That's right. And it was a dream. People thought it was fantasy. They thought it was crazy talk, that a woman should be able to just turn it on and off like a light switch and get pregnant when they wanted to and not when they didn't want to. And, you know, for as long as women have been getting pregnant, they've been trying not to, but with very poor results until the pill came along. It was very difficult for women to reliably control their fertility.
Not everybody, as we'll hear in this clip, agreed that women should have any control over their fertility.
Do you believe in sin?
When I say believe, I don't mean and believe in committing sin. Do you believe there is such a thing as sin?
Well, I think the greatest sin in the world is bringing children into the world that have disease from their parents, that have no chance in the world to be a human being, practically. Delinquents, prisoners, all sorts of things just marked when they're born. That, to me, is the greatest sin that people can commit.
That was Margaret Sanger talking to Mike Wallace in 1957. Sanger is a little bit problematic to deal with because she also had a relationship to eugenicists of the day. Can you kind of give us some perspective on that?
That's right. And I have to say in her defense that in the 1930s and 40s, especially before World War II, eugenics were a popular movement among intellectuals. There was this sense that we should encourage the well-off to breed and we should discourage the poor and the unhealthy from breeding. And this was a popular movement. There were college campuses where classes were taught on eugenics. Sanger, I think, was very pragmatic about it. I think it wasn't she was not a racist, I don't believe. I believe that she was looking for all the allies she could get to further her cause of improving options for birth control for women. And she saw a powerful ally in the eugenicists, and she definitely, made a pact and worked with them and took advantage of their resources. So she is a complicated woman, and her motivations were I think always good, but not always pure.
What sort of options existed before the birth control pill for people who wanted to have sex but did not want a baby or another baby? It should be noted.
Well, the options were fairly crude and oftentimes inaccessible. Obviously, there were condoms, but condoms relied on the participation and cooperation of men. So if women were not able to get that cooperation, the options available to them were things like IUDs and diaphragms, which were not as effective as the birth control pill, not by a long shot. And even those required some cooperation from men because you had to go to a doctor to get that. So if you were a young woman who was not married and you went to your doctor asking for birth control, you would be sent out of the office. There were clinics even in the 1940s and 50s that required you to show a receipt from a wedding dress if you went in and asked for birth control.
It's hard to imagine how people would respond to that sort of thing now, but it sounds like, you know, when the medical profession was overwhelmingly male, this was simply the way people thought about things.
That's right. Women were seen as having one role, and that was to produce children. Womanhood pretty much equaled motherhood in these days. And, you know, it's shocking for people to think about it now. We take it for granted. But prior to the 1950s, marital rape was not a crime. If your husband raped you, that was not even grounds for divorce. And you were expected to carry that child. Women had no real way to control their own fertility. That was the key word for Margaret Sanger when she invented the term birth control. Control.
And in fact, it was illegal in a lot of places to even share information about the things that might work to prevent pregnancy.
That's right. Even the dissemination of information about birth control was illegal, going back to the late 1800s when Anthony Comstock helped pass these Comstock laws in the federal law, and as well state laws adopted their own called mini-Comstock laws. And the idea was to cut down on things like pornography, anything that would make us a more promiscuous society, and included in that was birth control. People believed that birth control fostered promiscuity. It was not seen as a tool for women's health or for women's independence. It was seen as something that aided and abetted sexual looseness.
Is there any way to know, Jonathan, whether any of that worked? Because people weren't really keeping statistics back then, and I would imagine a lot of people who were single and having sex would be motivated to lie.
Yeah, there was not a lot of scientific research on this. We do know that these birth control options were not very effective, and people had a very poor understanding of what even worked as birth control. You know, a lot of women used douches and believed that that was the best way, and it was very, very ineffective. You had about a 50-50 chance of getting pregnant. You know, you were really just rolling the dice.
How did Margaret Sanger and Catherine McCormick come to be allies?
Well, Margaret Sanger, since the 19-teens, had been saying that she dreamed of a better form of birth control, and she fought for clinics. She opened clinics all around the country and founded what would eventually become Planned Parenthood. And one of her early supporters was Catherine Dexter McCormick, a very wealthy woman who had married into the McCormick family of Chicago, the family that produced the Reaper and founded International Harvester, had a great deal of wealth. But Catherine McCormick's husband became ill, suffered from schizophrenia, and had to be institutionalized. And she spent most of the rest of her marriage looking for a cure and taking care of her husband. When her husband finally died and she inherited this vast fortune, she returned to Margaret Sanger and said, "What's happening on birth control research? I want to do whatever I can. I want to devote whatever money I have, whatever time I have left." They were both old women by now. They were in their 70s. And McCormick said, I'm prepared to get back to work on birth control." And Sanger said, "Well, that's great. Let's see what we can do." But of course, she still didn't have any way to spend that money because there was no research going on birth control in this country.
And there was no research because it seemed just it was such a third rail topic that universities didn't want to touch it. And even drug companies figure there wasn't much money in it.
It was too controversial, and I don't think anybody recognized the scientific possibilities. They, you know, the scientists that Sanger approached all said it's impossible. You could never make such a pill, and even if you could, no drug company would dare make it because these products are illegal. So, what sense does it make for anybody to get involved in a project like that?
I thought it was very poignant that although Catherine McCormick had, in her early life, before she was married, been very interested in women's rights, after her husband became ill and died, one of the things she said was that she was grateful that she hadn't had a child with him because that child might have inherited his illness.
That's right. And I do think that fueled her passion for birth control, the realization that had she gotten pregnant on her honeymoon, that she might have passed along the illness that so debilitated her husband really terrified her. And I think it helped her personally understand what women went through when they didn't want to have children and really couldn't be prevented from, you know, there was nothing they could do to prevent from having children.
So how did Sanger and McCormick find their way to Gregory Pincus as the right scientist to approach about developing this miracle pill?
this is when the story really takes off and where I fell in love with these characters and just with these unlikely crusaders. This guy named Gregory Goodwin Pincus is working out of his own laboratory that he's built in a converted garage in Worcester, Massachusetts. He's completely on his own, independent. There's nothing like this in the country. There are no independent scientific laboratories. But he's been forced to do this because he's been released from Harvard. Harvard deemed him too controversial back in the 1930s when he was experimenting with in vitro fertilization. Something we now embrace as a great scientific breakthrough, but in the 1930s scared the hell out of people. It was seen as Frankenstein stuff, that you could make babies in test tubes. The world went crazy when they heard what Pincus was working on. He was also Jewish at a time of great anti-Semitism at Harvard, and Harvard cut him loose, and he could not find a job anywhere. So he goes and starts his own laboratory. He's working in Worcester, Mass., and he meets Sanger, and Sanger says she's been looking for this pill. She's dreamed of this miracle tablet that would allow women to turn on and off their reproductive systems. And for 30 years, everybody's been telling her it's impossible. And Pincus just looks at her and says, I can do that. You know, matter of fact, he understands off the top of his head how a birth control pill would work. He's able to explain to her the hormones. And this is something that Americans and scientists all over the world are just beginning to understand, how hormones control the body. And Pincus thinks he can use hormones. He can use progesterone in particular to trick a woman's body into thinking it's pregnant so that she won't get pregnant again, basically.
My guest is journalist Jonathan Eig. His new book is called The Birth of the Pill: How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
They come in big bottles for a year's supply, smaller bottles for a month's supply, and handy calendar packs that fit in a woman's purse. They are contraceptive or birth control pills, and 3 million women in North America swallow them daily to prevent pregnancy. They are beyond doubt the most effective contraceptive ever devised. The man who is responsible for the discovery of the pill is Dr. John Rock of Boston, a Roman Catholic. Our reporter, Katie Johnson, asked him why the enthusiasm for the pill.
It stops ovulation, so there is no egg.
How effective is it?
If taken as it should be, one pill every day for 3 weeks, it will stop ovulation.
What happens?
100%.
Do you automatically become pregnant if you forget to take a pill? I've heard that.
Well, it requires more than cessation of the pill to become pregnant, and it requires more than an egg. No, ovulation would not occur inevitably if one just missed a couple of pills.
That was Dr. John Rock in a 1964 interview with Canadian television. We're speaking this hour with Jonathan Eig, former reporter for The Wall Street Journal, author now of the new book, The Birth of the Pill: How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Jonathan, we'll talk about Dr. John Rock in just a minute, but there's so much I love in that clip, not least of which is the fact that people who were ready to use the pill clearly didn't fully understand the mechanisms behind pregnancy, even in 1964.
It is shocking, and when you study the subject, you realize that it really wasn't until the 1930s and 40s that even the medical world understood really how babies were made. You know, we think it seems so obvious now, but the whole ovulation process was not well understood. The idea of when women were fertile was not understood. It really wasn't until the 20th century that we even understood that there was an egg involved. People thought that babies sprang from the sperm and that women were just vessels for these babies that grew from the sperm in their womb. So it was It was a pretty steep learning curve in the 20th century.
It's pretty interesting as well, the fact that you hear Dr. Rock, who was an obstetrician and gynecologist, dancing around explaining to this poor young woman that she would have to have sex in order to become pregnant while using the pill.
Yeah, there was a little bit of a delicate situation there where, a gynecologist like Rock speaking on radio would be a little nervous about what he says. Obviously, the woman was not asking whether there would be a miracle conception. I think she probably understood that you still had to have sex to have a baby, even if you stopped taking the pill. But Rock was dancing around that a little bit.
So he was initially, his focus with his patients was helping people conceive a child when they had trouble doing so. How did he get involved in bringing the pill, developing the pill, and then bringing it to market?
Dr. Rock was one of the nation's most respected OBGYNs, and worked at Harvard in a clinic there, and saw some of the wealthiest and well-to-do women in the region, but also saw a lot of poor clients, a lot of poor patients, I should say, who were tired of having too many children and asking for some kind of help. At the same time, he was seeing women in the 1950s who were unable to conceive. And they were fretting because this was a time of the baby boom getting started, and the average woman had something like 3.7 children in the 1950s, and they were, if you couldn't have a baby, there was a great stigma about it. So they would come to him seeking help for fertility treatments, and that's how he began experimenting with progesterone. He thought that if he gave women progesterone, it might rest their reproductive systems. They wouldn't be able to get pregnant while they were on the progesterone, but perhaps when they stopped taking progesterone, their bodies would enjoy kind of a rebound, and they might have a better shot at getting pregnant. And that's what brought him together with Gregory Pincus. Pincus is looking for a birth control product, an oral birth control pill, and he's also experimenting with progesterone. And the two of them realize they've been messing around with the same hormones, and maybe they can collaborate. And that's where the story really gets interesting, because they start giving the pill to women. Actually, it's in the form of an injection at first. They start giving the progesterone to women who are seeking treatment for infertility. So women who are trying to have babies are really the first women to get this experimental new hormone that shuts down their reproductive systems. And it's just one of the many ways that Pincus and Rock had to go about their work in a sneaky way, because they couldn't advertise that they were experimenting with birth control. Birth control was illegal in Massachusetts at the time.
Hmm. Why was it such a hurdle to develop an oral form of progesterone?
Well, all of these hormones were new, and science was just beginning to understand how they controlled the functions of the human body. So finding out whether progesterone worked was relatively simple. You can put it in lab animals, in injections, and it did shut down the ovulation very effectively. But then when you take it to humans, it's another story, and Sanger was absolutely insistent that an injection was not good enough. This had to be something women could do on their own. As I said earlier, the key word in birth control was control. And if women were going to have control over their own bodies and make their own decisions about when they were going to have children, they needed to be able to take a pill, not have to go to their doctors to get a shot. So Sanger was insistent. And it just took a little longer for them to figure out the right chemical compound that would work, not just in an injection, but also released in a slower way in the form of a tablet.
So once the sort of chemical makeup was refined somewhat, it turned out the birth control pills were quite safe if used correctly and under the care of a doctor. But when the earliest human trials began, nobody really knew what these things might do. And one of the risks that people were at least a little bit concerned about was that they might sort of trigger an early menopause or render women sterile.
There was a lot of fear about it. People didn't really know if it would have any effect on the babies that were born later. They didn't know if it might permanently render women infertile. And you think about it, this is a pill for healthy women. This is a pill that for women in their 20s, who have long productive lives ahead of them. And you're giving this pill every day to women without any idea what the long-term effects might be. If you can see for a month or two that it shuts down reproduction, great. But what happens if people take it for 2 years, 3 years? We had no idea what the impact might be. So this was very controversial, and really they were up against some steep hurdles. The other problem was that because they wanted to make sure it was completely effective, they ramped the doses up really high, much higher than they needed to be. So women were suffering terrible nausea, dizziness, all kinds of side effects, even some reports of blood clots, you know, some serious side effects. So women were dropping out of this of these early trials left and right. They found nurses and medical school students, women who were compelled to be in these studies. They threatened them that they would have their grades lowered if they didn't agree to participate. And even those women just refused to go along because the side effects were so bad.
This was also tested on people who were not in a position to say no.
That's right. They tested it on women who were in insane asylums. They also tried giving it to some men in those insane asylums just for the hell of it.
It didn't work out.
No. When the men complained about side effects, they stopped right away. The women, they kept going. But to be fair, the side effects were much more severe for the men. So they gave up that idea pretty quickly. And I should also mention that Sanger was insistent that they should not even pursue any interest in a male birth control pill. She absolutely wanted something for women. That was the real goal here, was to make sure women had some control. And if they came up with a pill for men, it would not have done the job for her.
So certainly Catholicism remains a large religion in the United States, but it's not the only one. Why was the potential objection of the Catholic Church such a concern here?
Well, the Catholic Church is a strong force in American life, and I don't know the percentage, but a very large percentage of the American public was Catholic, and politicians did not want to get on the wrong side of Catholic voters. And the Catholic Church played a very strong role in American life and just in American culture. And this was something that the Church had wrestled with for many years and still wrestles with today over whether women should and men should be permitted to have sex for pleasure, whether it the teachings of the Church that it should be only for procreation. And this threatened that idea. The Church did make an exception for the rhythm method. That was beginning back in the 1930s. They began to allow women to have sex when they were in a period when they were not fertile. And the makers of the pill tried to argue that the birth control pill was really just an improvement on the rhythm method. And they took that argument all the way to the Vatican, and the Vatican considered it for quite a while. This was a really key moment for the Church because they had a chance to really think about shifting their stance. And they knew that women were interested in this pill and that they were in many cases breaking away from what the Church told them to do. For the first time, they were openly saying to their priests, no, I got to disagree with you on this one. It's too important for me. I have to be on this pill. It's not good for my health. It's not good for my family. I can't afford to have another child right now. So they were willing to go against the Church really for the first time in an open way.
The Vatican Synod last week failed to endorse any real change in the Church's position on most forms of birth control. But it is, it's notable that a significant percentage of Catholic women in their childbearing years have, in fact, used the pill.
The overwhelming majority. It's something like 90%. And, in the United States, it's more than 99% of women have used contraception. So it's clear that the Church has lost the battle here, and they're continuing to hold on to their principles. But the women have spoken. They've decided for themselves what they believe.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Jonathan Eig about his new book, The Birth of the Pill: How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. You can be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
I think they're marvelous.
Would you use them?
I am using them.
Well, I think it's much easier than anything to use. There's nothing to it, really. You just take the pill.
Well, as I said, I really don't need them. I'm a good Presbyterian, and I've never thought of using them because I don't indulge in such practices, to put it that way.
I feel that it certainly shouldn't be shut off from the unmarried people. I feel that if it's going to exist, then it should exist for the people who need it most, it seems to me the people who aren't, the ones that are married.
Do you think the pill may tend to make women promiscuous?
No, not any more than they are.
Another wonderful clip from our colleagues at the CBC, Canadian Broadcast Corporation, in 1964. We're speaking this hour with journalist Jonathan Eig, author of the new book, The Birth of the Pill, How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. So, Jonathan, did the pill launch the sexual revolution or just coincide with it?
I think the pill helped along the sexual revolution. It certainly helped fuel that revolution. But there were a number of forces already underway before the pill arrived on the scene. The Kinsey Report, Masters and Johnson. You had this sexual awakening in the 1950s after the war. You know, and part of it goes as far back as the war, because men went overseas and experimented more, and women had more independence while their men were gone overseas. They began entering the workforce more. All of these forces began to come together. And the pill is just maybe the last straw, the final match that ignites this great flame, because if there's more sex and more promiscuity, it's going to be dragged down tremendously if there's also a lot more pregnancy. And the pill obviously helps make everything go a lot easier.
I love that when the pill was first approved by the Food and Drug Administration, its contraceptive function was really listed as a side effect.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts of the story, too. And it ties in with this whole idea that these people were really renegades. They were operating like guerrilla warriors. They had to do this thing clandestinely and try to stay under the radar. So in 1956, when they were ready to apply to the FDA for approval, they decided not to ask for approval as birth control, but to ask for the approval as a pill to regulate women's cycles. And that was brilliant, because you're able to avoid so much of the controversy, and you don't raise those great big red flags. And the FDA approved it, and this was also in part driven by the fact that a big corporation, the G.D. Searle Company, had agreed to manufacture this, but they were nervous. They were afraid of the backlash, in particular from the Catholic Church, and other drug companies had said no, they would not get involved. But G.D. Searle decided to go ahead, but they said, let's try it first, just as as something that regulates women's cycles. Of course, doctors knew exactly what it did, and the bottle came with a label, a warning on the label that said, this pill also prevents pregnancy. So it was the best advertising they ever could have had, and thousands of women went to their doctor and started saying that they needed help for their irregular cycles.
Is it true that the inactive days included in a monthly regimen of birth control pills were initially left there to create what amounts to really like a false menstrual period?
Yeah, that is true. And it's because the drug company, Searle, was nervous that this would be seen as unnatural. So they wanted this pill to mimic the natural cycle as much as possible. They didn't have to include a period in there. They didn't have to have a few days each month for women to menstruate. But they decided that it would be better, that it would just make this feel like a much more natural product.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Ed on the line in Arlington. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Mr. Eig. Given that, given the recording you played earlier, and the fact that admittedly it takes 9 months after impregnation before a baby comes flying down the chute, and it even
they don't come flying, but go ahead.
And even takes 4 or 5 months for a woman to really even start showing she's pregnant. Can you comment on how long it's been generally understood in Western civilization or really anywhere in the world that having sex is what causes people to have babies?
I think people figured that out a long, long time ago. Perhaps back in the in prehistoric days, cause and effect became pretty clear. And I think also in agricultural societies, people saw their animals mating and figured out very quickly why they were mating. So that goes way, way back. That's the one thing that I think everybody understood pretty quickly.
All right, let's
the rest
go
of it was a mystery.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Claire on the line in Dallas. Hi, Claire.
Hi. I was wondering if Jonathan could discuss Sanders' possibly racist motivations in developing the pill.
That's a good question. You know, were there racist motivations in developing the pill? Yes, there were. In fact, you know, a lot of people who were pushing for birth control were eugenicists. Planned Parenthood had some controversies early on because some people believed that their mission was really to reduce reduce population in certain communities. So there was a lot of controversy about it. And there were people within that movement who believed that it was important to have a pill so that only the intelligent would reproduce, or that only families that were really well equipped to have babies, and that was code word often for white wealthy families. And it's also important to note that some of these early experiments with the pill were done in Puerto Rico in the slums of San Juan on, you know, darker skinned women, and it was seen as okay to experiment on those folks down there. You know, those are some of the real ethical problems that were encountered in this early research, and that, you know, still haunt the product today, because it was, you know, there were a lot of women who suffered as a result of those early clinical trials.
How quickly was the pill in common use after it was introduced?
Almost overnight. Within the first year of its approval, 400,000 women in America were receiving prescriptions for the pill. And the year after that, that number tripled to about 1.2, 1.3 million women. And it tripled again the year after that. It spread like wildfire.
How and why did Margaret Sanger, by the way, get crosswise with Planned Parenthood, which, after all, was the organization she founded under another name?
That's right. Well, Sanger helped start Planned Parenthood, and as she got older, she became more radical and was really focused intently on using whatever time and resources she had left on scientific research, and she was frustrated that Planned Parenthood was more focused on education and trying to open more clinics and reach more people. She believed that they were moving too slowly and they were too conservative in their approach to scientific research. And, you know, Planned Parenthood understandably might have feared that getting behind an untested product that could cause harm to women and might lead to litigation could present problems for the organization that they had built. So I think that's why she had this falling out with the organization. And she, as she got older, became increasingly cantankerous. She had drug and alcohol problems. It was a very stormy relationship.
Do you think your four main characters here, Sanger, McCormick, Rock, and Pincus, would they be surprised that more than 50 years later, lots of Americans are still debating the appropriateness of the use of the birth control pill?
I think they'd be shocked, because they really believe that once this got out there, once women had this power to control their reproductive systems, that everything else would take care of itself, and so much did. I think they'd be pleasantly surprised. I think they'd be pleased and reassured to see that so many women have gone on to have great careers, and you know, the number of women in law school today is equal to the number of men. Great opportunities have abounded. Poverty has been reduced. Unwanted pregnancies have been reduced. Contraception has helped lower abortion rates. All of these things were things they hoped for, and those things have come true. But I think they'd be surprised that we're still fighting over what seemed to have been established as a right for women to control their own bodies.
It is funny that we're debating it, and yet it continues to be in very common use. 10 million women in America currently.
That's right. And, you know, it's been proven safe. It's been proven effective. It has had tremendous benefits on health for women. We didn't even talk about that. We've been talking about the cultural effects. It reduces, you know, infant mortality dramatically. And yet, you know, we still debate whether it's a good thing. I'm always a little surprised. And especially, you know, when you think about the fact that it, you know, even conservatives should be pleased that it reduces the abortion rate.
The new book by author Jonathan Eig, formerly of the Dallas Morning News and the Wall Street Journal, is called The Birth of the Pill: How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. Jonathan, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking to you.
We want to thank all of you who are listening today. We always love knowing that you are with us on these explorations of topics about pretty much everything under the sun and even beyond the sun on our astronomy days. Your contribution to the show as a listener really matters. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks.